Welcome to Luck is Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. From Tacoma to Coos Bay, the multinational frack gas industry is desperately trying to gain a foothold for new fossil fuel infrastructure. Today we talk about these gas campaigns in the language of deception with activists on the front lines of fighting major LNG projects in the Northwest. Claudia Riedner is the co-founder of Redefine Tacoma, a grassroots environmental group working to stop Tacoma LNG. And Larry Mangan is a landowner in Coos County, Oregon, whose 100-acre ranch is threatened by the Pacific Connector pipeline that would carry frack gas to the proposed Jordan Cove LNG terminal along Coos Bay. And in the studio, we have with us Dan Sears, conservation director with Columbia Riverkeeper, who's been helping coordinate struggles to stop frack gas projects across the region. Claudia, Larry, and Dan, welcome back to Luck is Focus.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Well, we're going to start by talking about just what greenwashing is, because even though the people in the room and on the phone probably think of this as just kind of an everyday term, I've actually come to understand that not everybody understands what it is. So I want to start by having each one of you, just give me a short description of what you think greenwashing is. And I'll start with Dan, who's here in the studio with me.
Yeah, from my view, it's when someone who intends to pollute takes your issue, the idea of sustainability or climate action, and tries to really co-opt it and use that as an argument in favor of a polluting activity. And so I think it's interesting because it's sort of a quiet acknowledgement that maybe you have a point in that polluting is bad, polluting the climate, polluting the water. At the same time, it's just maddening for people to see huge industrial projects painting themselves as if they will benefit the environment or people's drinking water, those issues.
And Claudia, what do you think it is?
I think it's on a spectrum, and it starts by, you know, sending promotional materials, for example, or information that only tells half truth and that omits any and all negative effects of a project. And it goes all the way to the other side of the spectrum to where they tell outright lies and complete deception and anything in between.
And Larry?
Well, I think it's the taking a project that is fundamentally a dirty project, for example, a frack gas pipeline, and sending out multicolored brochures and making it look environmentally sound and like mother and apple pie, like it's something everyone would want.
Well, actually, I've had some wonderful conversations with people over the last few years about how maybe the most charismatic of all greenwashing is the name of this gas that is they want to pipe through your property, Larry, and make into a liquid form in your community, Claudia. It's this word natural gas. So I guess I want to kind of get a response about, because I think natural gas is a pretty old term. But I remember I was doing my last documentary, which was about oil, actually, and we made some mention about natural gas, and a friend of mine who's a longtime activist just kind of blew up, almost hit the roof of my studio, going on about what a horribly deceptive term that is. So let's talk about the whole concept of natural gas and how that is kind of a charismatic way of showing how greenwashing works.
Just imagine if Northwest Natural's name was Northwest Fracked. It gives you a pretty good sense of the power of that natural gas term. It is very old, and it comes from, you know, the 1970s or before. And there's a great article up on Sightline where Tariqa Powell talks about the flaws with calling methane gas. We call it fracked gas because most of the methane gas in our system is produced through fracking. And so Larry was right on it. Right off the bat, he calls it a fracked gas pipeline. And so people around the Northwest have been working really hard for the last couple years now to peel back that really glossy veneer of natural gas and to call it what it is, fracked gas.
Barbara,
yeah.
I've got an insight. You know, I'm 72, and I remember as a kid seeing the Westinghouse commercials with the big blue flame, and you're cooking with gas. Just part of our culture. But this, what they're proposing to potentially put through my property is gas that comes from wells that are all kinds of chemicals, but they won't even tell you all the chemicals they use, and water, use of in soil of water, and then put it in a pipeline and then ship it over here to be frozen and then shipped overseas. So it's taking something that we all grew up with, or at least I grew up with in my generation, and now it's not that anymore. It's a chemically induced fracked material.
But actually, I think of natural gas, it's never been that great a substance. It's never been the kind of clean, wonderful thing that we grew up thinking it was. But it didn't dawn on me. One of the things when I moved to Oregon and I lived in these houses that had oil furnaces, and there's a big thing to convert it to gas because that was so much cleaner. But then I remember there was this big pipeline explosion out by North Bonneville, just across the river from Cascade Locks. And it blew up this hot springs resort that had just been finished, which I think had just opened, and destroyed it. And it was a real eye-opener to me because I had never really thought about natural gas pipelines exploding. And I realized this is really a dangerous thing. And it was the first kind of crack in my sense of natural gas being a good thing. So I think that that's another thing that's really weird to think about, this really explosive, volatile, dangerous, poisonous substance, which has been tagged natural.
You know, before they called industry, renamed it or rebranded it to natural gas, it was actually called combustible air. And I think that's a really pretty good term because it's odorless, it's invisible, just like air, and yes, it blows up all the time.
And now it's freedom gas.
Freedom gas, that's right.
Maybe we should do a little background on what freedom gas is, Dan.
Freedom prize.
Yeah, the Trump administration is talking about rebranding natural gas as freedom gas, which I think is a mistake, of course, because natural gas is about as good a branding as you can get. Yeah, and it's just another strange push where we see greenwashing happening now, not just at the corporate level with these companies who propose these things, but actually coming out of government institutions who are adopting and even pushing the envelope further. And I think the other thing I want to say about gas and fracked gas is that we simply know more now than we did several years ago. We know more about the greenhouse gas pollution impacts of gas production, transmission, and use. And we know that, you know, depending on how it's produced, gas can approach or even exceed coal for its greenhouse gas pollution impacts. We're in a different time, and it's almost as if the gas industry is trying to claw us back to and keep us in the dark about what we really have to do to address the climate crisis. And one of those things is to get off of gas and to certainly not build new huge projects to double down on that addiction to fracked gas. And that's what folks like Claudia and Larry are working on so hard in their towns.
Well, I think that some of the things that we are up against are some of it, I think, is like government-sponsored things like cities going in Portland, for instance, transform many of its buses to being run by frack gas a few years ago, and there'd be a big sign on the back of the bus saying, this bus is clean bus by, you know, run on natural gas. Just the other day, I saw a waste management garbage truck touting how clean its fuel was. It was, again, quote, natural gas. And that there's still like a big gap, it seems, between what we know about the huge carbon footprint of frack gas and what we still have in our mind about how natural gas is a better alternative or it's a bridge fuel. So let's talk a bit about this myth about natural gas being a bridge fuel. I know Eric DePlace at Sightline has talked about how that might have been true in the 70s. I'm not even sure that's really the case now that what we know about it. So what does it mean that it's a bridge fuel, and why is that such a dangerous thought? And actually, I'll have Claudia start on that one.
Well, I think what it means is by its very term, it means it needs to get us from here to there. And that might have been true maybe 20 years ago, maybe 30 years ago, where we already knew that there were pollution impacts from fossil fuels. But now we know we are there. We know climate emergency is happening all around the planet. So we simply have no time. We don't have time to build the same old bridges. And I think we also need to understand that it's not a simple mathematical formula to switch one fuel for another. And it has to do with our never-ending consumption and with assumptions that our economy needs to grow, and that's the only way of doing it. Because we know we have one planet and we have finite resources. And to continue overuse these finite resources is cutting directly into our future expectations of a sustainable life.
Dan?
Yeah, and I think that the idea of a bridge fuel is you know, people started rejecting that more than 10 years ago and really walking away from that idea, realizing that the type of climate changing pollution we were seeing globally was not going to be addressed by even a marginal improvement over coal. And what we learn now and since then has been fracked gas is really not even a marginal improvement over coal, at least for the production of electricity. And what we see now is, you know, more and more the gas industry trying to find other creative ways to insinuate itself into all the products that are out there, plastics. You know, they're trying to find ways to convince regulators to approve more gas-fired power plants, so our electricity grid, and so many petrochemicals like methanol, like anhydrous ammonia. So we're seeing this industry really get pointed in a lot of different directions because there's just so much production of fracked gas right now. And so what we're seeing is really a lock-in of fossil fuels, of fracked gas, and of oil. And that another great resource is Oil Change International, which has talked about the United States becoming essentially the Saudi Arabia of, well, we are now the largest producer of oil and gas in the world. And that's sort of a shocking thing to realize when about 10 years ago, the same people who were bringing us LNG export were telling us the sky was falling, we needed to import liquefied natural gas. So we're really in a weird time where I think it's confusing for people. And that's why I appreciate, you know, the work that people do in their own communities day in and day out to educate folks about the need to move towards renewable energy. And I think Larry's part of a group called Citizens for Renewables, which is kind of amazing considering that that group started out being called Citizens Against LNG. And it's a great example of kind of the positive messaging that can really combat this directly.
Well, I was thinking about 15 years ago, I was in this fellowship program at the University of Colorado, and it was a time when there was a big debate going on, actually, on NPR about climate change and whether it was man-made induced or not. And there were all these scientists who were addressing us at this fellowship who were very upset that NPR was acting like it was still a he said, she said controversy. It obviously was not, and they were laying on us as journalists, environmental journalists. We really needed to awaken the world to the fact that this is a real bogus argument. But there was one debate about between a bunch of different scientists about bridge fuels, and the debate was between gas or nuclear power. And then there was one guy who was in the room who was tearing his hair out because he was saying this is not going to work, neither one. But it seemed to me, as I was watching this debate go on, that it's not really about what's the better bridge fuel. It had to do with investments, which industries' investments were going to be the ones that took charge. And that seems to be the biggest problem, is getting the gas industry now. I think nuclear power is probably going away on its own merits, maybe not, or lack of merits. But it seems like the fracked gas industry still has such a stronghold, them and the railroads, as far as trying to regulate themselves and trying to put their own message out. And I wonder how that can be countered.
Barb, can I just add one thing on the bridge fuel issue? And I'll bring it down to the specifics of the Pacific Connector gas pipeline, the Jordan Cove pipeline, and whether or not it was perhaps at one time in the past a bridge fuel, but right now what they're looking at in our community is they would lock it in if it's approved for 30 years. So this bridge is not a short bridge at all. This, once they approve something like this, it's a 30-year, at least 30-year plus lock-in of that quote-unquote bridge. So that's what's the problem, I think.
And Daniel, let me just let.
Oh, I just think that's a great point. Thank you for saying that, Larry. The same is true for the Klamath Methanol Refinery, where they're talking about, you know, 30, 40 years of making methanol out of fracked gas. And they're trying to claim that that's some huge carbon benefit, which is just unbelievably inaccurate and maddening for everyone who's involved. And I think what I'm learning is that the most effective pushback comes from people talking to their neighbors and their friends and organizing in these local communities, what people are doing all across Southern Oregon, what people have done in Tacoma and are doing now. You know, they ran off the methanol company that we are still fighting in Kalama, and they're now dealing with their own LNG issue. And that's what I think is inspiring, is that when people hear the truth from their neighbors and their friends and from, you know, well-meaning activists from all over the region, they tend to believe it. And so the more desperate the industry gets to paint itself as clean, green economy makers, as they called it in Kalama. I think the more they fall short and the more it rings hollow, but we're definitely in a multi-year battle here to wrest the narrative of climate change away from the fossil fuel industries who want to provide these false solutions.
Claudia, you have any thoughts?
You brought up investments, and I think that's a very important point, because what it means is that, for example, Puget Sound Energy, who is now a Canadian-owned multinational gas monopoly in our area, they provide 10 Western Washington County with gas. By them investing into this infrastructure, there are multiple negative outfalls from it. For one, it snuffs out all available and potential monies to actually focus on renewable and build a new infrastructure here in our town that's already been, you know, hampered by the fossil fuel industry. But it also, for example, the people that bought Puget Sound Energy is a Canadian pension fund interest. And so they're actually creating monies for people's pensions, while here in Washington State, the public pensions are not funded by fossil fuels. So Washington State banned fracking, and they're not investing their pension monies into fossil fuels, which is really great. But then fossil fuel infrastructure that pumps in the gas from Canada and then sends the profits back out to Canada. So I think investments are a really important point to look at, especially since this LNG would be funded by local ratepayers. Up to 43% of the entire refinery would be funded by ratepayers. I mean, net benefits would only be 1%, and according to PSD, only for about 10 years. So all our money is being put into something that really we don't want and we don't need.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking about the greenwashing of frack gas. We're talking with Claudia Riedner, co-founder of Redefine Tacoma, Larry Mangan, a landowner in Coos County who's threatened by the Pacific Connector Pipeline, and Dan Sears, conservation director with Columbia Riverkeeper. I wanted to get a little bit, we were talking just a little bit about kind of government-sponsored greenwashing. It seems to me that we're seeing that really at play with two final supplementary environmental impact statements that were released, one just last week about the Klamath Methanol Refinery and one 6 months ago about the Tacoma LNG facility. So I want to talk about the kinds of, quote, science that's used in both of these studies and how they are actually a form of greenwashing.
Yeah, I mean, to start with the Klamath project, we saw the final environmental impact statement released on Friday, a Friday of Labor Day dump there. And what they released was essentially a rehash of their draft environmental impact statement. And so the history of this is similar to what happened in Tacoma, where they did an environmental analysis a couple years ago. They completely failed to look at the greenhouse gas impacts of the gas that would be used to make the methanol. And then, so they were compelled by a court to write a new one and to write an EIS that was specific to this greenhouse gas issue. So what they did is they took a big swing. They took a big swing at trying to convince everyone that not only was this not bad for the climate, in fact, it was like the best thing ever for the climate. And so the document is worth reading if you want. Yeah, you know, some. It's basically humorous to see the company make these outrageous claims that they will be taking millions of tons of carbon out of the atmosphere. We know the opposite is true. We know that building the world's largest gas to methanol refinery is going to produce huge quantities of carbon pollution, and far more than they estimate. One of the issues that we're seeing with this company is that in its desperation to avoid looking at the impact of actually burning methanol, they have made this very dubious claim that they will never use the methanol for fuel. And we caught them basically lying, telling their investors that, oh, of course the methanol will be used for fuel, while at the same time telling regulating agencies like the Department of Ecology and the port and the county that no, the methanol will never be used for fuel. The reason why this is important is that it allows them to pretend as if the carbon all stays locked up in plastic. So this is the ultimate greenwashing fail, where if the best thing you can say about your methanol refinery is that it's going to make more plastic, it's probably not very good. And so it's the problem is we have two agencies in the port and the county who essentially let Northwest Innovation Works guide and write this environmental impact statement. And so the backstop here is the Washington Department of Ecology, and they're going to have to decide whether this is adequate or not. And they have to decide whether or not a shorelines permit gets issued and this environmental impact statement stands. That's very important because this is potentially a precedent-setting event where you have a company writing its own analysis, one that hasn't been done many times before in Washington, and kind of setting the template how other companies could come in and say, well, yeah, we might produce millions of tons of greenhouse gas pollution, but you know, maybe we'll offset some other worse type of pollution somewhere else. And so in that case, we're actually better for the environment. This is the same argument that Coos Bay has made from ever since it admitted that it was exporting LNG. It's the same argument they're making in Tacoma at the hearing just a few days ago, this past week, where hundreds of people, I think, really pierced the veil of that greenwashing. And what was one of the most impressive hearings I've seen in a long time in terms of public testimony. And for the methanol project, it's really important that people stay connected and engaged with this. We're entering a time now where the state of Washington is going to have to make a call on this, and they have to decide whether they're going to allow these companies to warp the environmental review process in such a way that greenwashing, corporate greenwashing, is going to be indistinguishable from the actual environmental reviews that people rely on to evaluate these projects. And we can't let that stand. And so, you know, we have a petition up on our website at columbiariverkeeper.org, a couple short summary of why the EIS is so flawed. And we're going to be in the next month working with all the partners we have in the Frack Gas Coalition to really push back on this.
Well, Claudia, what are some of the concerns that you've raised about the type of science that's being used in these studies and some of the problems with that science?
I think Dan touched on something incredibly important, and that is that all these new gas facilities are precedent setting, not only in Washington, but also in Oregon and in you know, California, if they ever were to have one. And so by using this faulty science, we're basically letting others after these facilities slip in under completely false pretenses. So what we've noticed as we were combing through the Tacoma LNG SEIS, is that they, for example, assumed climate harming effects of methane over 100 years, when clearly the facility is only designed for 40 years, when clearly the most harm is happening in the first 20 years, when methane is actually 85 times, not percent, but times worse as a climate harming gas. And then the other issue that I feel like is really troubling is what is called agency capture. And that means an agency, a public agency, is not, in fact, working to protect the public from harm, but is indeed only working to allow industry to go about their business. And what we've learned from Puget Sound Clean Air Agency, which was an agency I used to actually really trust and look to, that their entire board has been taking Puget Sound Energy campaign monies, and they have an advisory council, and that advisory council right now has open seats for a fire chief, for environmental justice, and for native tribes. So that the main functions of the advisory council are empty at this point, and that's when they're doing such crucial projects that actually happen on treaty-protected territory.
So you also mentioned in your testimony last Tuesday, you talked about how the Clean Air Agency is there to protect from toxins in the air, and you talked about the toxins in our democracy. And I wanted to go a little bit more into what you meant by that.
Well, you would assume that for example, an agency such as that or our city council would be open to the public, would have communications about such projects ahead of time, would thoroughly vet companies and projects and allow the public to have decent input all the way along the way. But for example, when they put this LNG through, when they did their first environmental impact study where people are allowed and invited to speak to it and have questions, they only informed people that live within 400 feet of the facility, and not only is this in the port where that's not inhabitable, but the facility itself has a 500-foot footprint, so simply nobody heard about it in this effect. Nobody got to really attend and investigate the facility or ask real questions. And as the law dictates, once an EIS is finished, you really have no more standing to ask any more questions. And so for years, we have been asking the city council, since they are the lead agency, they took over lead agency from the State Department of Ecology, we've been asking serious questions about pollution, health, safety, costs, and the city council simply refuses to engage in a dialogue at all.
Larry, I wonder from your end there, having witnessed a little bit of the Coos Bay City Council in action last March with you, and I know there was another meeting last week, how are your local governments kind of captured by the fossil fuel industry?
Well, let me give you an example. You're talking about the greenwashing, and I'm going to give you an example of anti-science that's really being perpetrated not only by FERC and the Jordan Cove, but maybe some of the local agencies as well. And that's the mitigation plan for the Jordan Cove for wetlands. As you know, the pipeline goes from Malin, Oregon, all the way to Coos Bay, 230 miles. And along that route, there's impacts to the estuary, estuarine impacts. There's freshwater impacts. There's more than 485 bodies of water and streams that are being crossed. So you've got riparian areas, you've got meadows, you've got a whole assortment of types of riparian wetland species or habitats that are being affected. And Jordan Cove is proposing, and FERC is buying off on it, is to mitigate all of those impacts to wetlands across the 230 in one particular area. Jordan Cove has purchased an old golf course, actually. It was an area that was diked off from the rest of the estuary in probably the 30s. And they bought this old golf course, let it go, and they're proposing all the wetland impacts along the course of the pipeline to be put right there. And most of your listeners don't know. I know you know, Barbara, that I was a wildlife biologist for my career for 40 years with the Bureau of Land Management. And I worked on many, many mitigation projects. And there are two fundamental laws when you do a mitigation project. It's got to be in place and be in kind. In place means that when you try to mitigate an impact to wetlands, you have to do it in a nearby area or it's to take care of what has actually been lost. And it has to be in kind. In kind means it has to be the same type of habitat. So by trying to mitigate the entire 230 miles of wetland disruption in this one area, it just goes against any science, anything that I've ever known of the probably hundreds of mitigation projects that I've worked on in my career. And it's being sold by the company as well. We've been, of course, hounded by all these pamphlets and in videos on TV, you know, showing all these beautiful salmon, they're going to be in the mitigation area, and it's acting like it's going to be so much better than it ever was before. Just incorrect.
Well, actually, I understand that there is going to be a pipeline that goes, to this golf course, and it's actually like going to be spewing dredge swirls or something. I mean, it seems like that the actual mitigation plan is going to be more polluting than not doing that at all.
Well, exactly. What they're doing is that they've got some dredging to do to straighten the channel so these big, huge aircraft carrier-sized tankers can get into Coos Bay. And they have the dredging material, they put in a pipe, and they're actually dumping the dredging material in this old golf course, now actually an acting freshwater wetland. And these, you know, Coos Bay's got a history of industrial shipbuilding back in the, 20s, 30s. There were a lot of ships, and earlier actually, a lot of ships built here, but there's a lot of people that know a lot more than I do about the sediments. There's a lot of heavy metals in the bay sediments. And so their company is producing, as you said, right, spewing that dredge spoils into that wetland, and that's part of the wetland mitigation, they're saying. And plus the actual pipe, the actual, not only the dredge spoil pipeline, but the actual Pacific Gas Connector pipeline goes through part of that restoration mitigation area as well. So it's a folly. It's a folly.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking about the greenwashing of frack gas with Larry Magnin, who's a landowner in Coos County, Oregon, whose property is threatened by the Pacific Connector Pipeline, Claudia Riedner, who's the co-founder of Redefine Tacoma, and Dan Sears, who's a conservation director with Columbia Riverkeeper. Well, you've been mentioning both Claudia and John and Larry about these these mailings you're getting. So, Larry, I want you to talk about what you call the giant Hallmark cards that you've been getting from Jordan Cove for the last few years.
Yeah, exactly. They are giant Hallmark cards. They come in the mail, and they're about 8.5 by 11. In fact, I'm holding one in my hand right now. It's a foldable. What you're looking at is an 8.5 by 11 sheet, but it's foldable. So it would be 33 inches long by 8.5, I guess, when it's unfolded. So the picture I'm looking at right now is beautiful. Actually, it's in the Cascades. We did a little research, and we found out where the picture was taken up near Mount Bachelor at Sparks Lake, if you know where that is.
Geez, is the pipeline going that far to Mount Bachelor?
No.
It's not even close to the pipeline.
That doesn't matter. With this Hallmark card, it doesn't matter. All it has to do is look good. It's got a big white lettering across this kind of blue sky. It's at sunset. The sun has gone down. And there's a little family. They're roasting marshmallows over a campfire. Got their sticks, and right next to them is their little tent. It looks like it's might be a Coleman lantern in it that's lighting it up. It's kind of glowing. And then a lake, Sparks Lake in the background, and the beautiful Cascades, and probably Mount Bachelor in the background. And above, splattered across the top is Respect Oregon. And then at the bottom, of course, Jordan Cove LNG, a Pembina company. And as I open it, and look on the back of it, again, another Respect Oregon. And boy, what do you know? Here's a project that is going to potentially harm 485 waterways. Beautiful setting. It looks like, I don't know, it could be the Deschutes River in Oregon. A father and assuming his son fly fishing. Oh, they've got their waders on, and they're casting out into this beautiful blue-green water, the mountains in the background, the trees. And then, of course, Respect Oregon. And, of course, here's the project that's going to affect probably salmon and fisheries more than any other project in recent history. And here you've got the people fly fishing. And then the only thing it doesn't have is a dog. Oh wait, here, I look up in the middle. And here, in the middle of the pamphlet, here's a dog, you know, a family pet, looking out over a scene of the mountains. And I guess the only thing it doesn't have is a baby. But, I mean, with the highlights, the Jordan Cove project will safely transport clean natural gas, creating jobs and protecting our natural resources. So this is one of three or four of these giant Hallmark cards we've gotten. And everyone that I've talked to, you know, it angers them when they get them. Of course, you know, my people I talk to are probably not maybe the best cross-section of the whole public, but I can't imagine even the folks that aren't involved with the pipeline, that they see right through this. And unless there's some hidden subliminal workings of this document, I think locals are really seeing through this, basically a multi-million-dollar attempt to buy their support.
No, it's not just these Hallmark cards you're getting, but also I hear that they pop up on your computer and you see them on television. So I mean, how widespread is this advertising campaign?
Well, they've actually had to cut back on some of it, so it's not as bad as it was. And I haven't gotten a giant Hallmark card in probably 3 or 4 months. They actually cut back by $50 million a lot of their expenses. I think they're worried, actually, if this project with the Department of Environmental Quality turning them down. But yeah, the nightly news, CBS Sunday Morning. We love that show, and we'd have to sit through Jordan Cove commercials. Or when I go to the gym, I listen to YouTube, on my cell phone and for music. And, you know, I have to listen to a Jordan Cove commercial before I can listen to the particular song I've selected on YouTube. It's insidious.
How about you, Claudia? I mean, I was looking at that PSE, the latest PSE mailer that you got, but how much of these kinds of mailings do you get in the Tacoma area?
Just like Larry, I'm holding a glossy, beautiful 8-page cardstock pamphlet in my hands, and kudos to PSE. They managed to put a photo of Mount Rainier on the cover, so at least they're in the right state. So what they're doing is they're saying that this project would save $50 to $100 million for PSE bait payers, but they're not saying that we're actually forced to pay $150 million, you know, for the construction of the refinery itself. And they also say that, you know, PSE LNG would clean up our air, when in fact they're not mentioning that this is a refinery that would be spewing out toxins 24/7, 365 days a year, toxins that include lead, you know, mercury, arsenic, and Tacoma has already a really bad history with arsenic. So the things they are telling us are very clearly designed to only sell this project, but it has no honesty in it about what's actually really going on as far as climate pollution or even the dangers. They're trying to tell us that LNG is completely safe and it has a safe track record, when Washington State has one other LNG facility out in Plymouth. And in 2014, that facility blew and it threw, you know, shrapnel for hundreds of feet and yards. And that facility explosion alone cost over $72 million in damages. And PSE's liability insurance is capped at $50 million. That insurance liability excludes any issues that have to do with tsunamis, lahars, earthquakes, and we have all those sea dangers in the port tide flats. So it's the financial risks are not clearly explained to their ratepayers or to the city. And it's incredibly deceptive, and they've been mailing these to tens of thousands of households. And this is not the first time. And besides, like you already mentioned, advertisement on TV and in the newspaper and online, everywhere you look, they're also calling people at home, and they're on their third push poll now. And these push polls are not only, like we said earlier, toxic for the misinformation, but they're directly toxic to our democracy, because they will, you know, subliminally promote certain candidates for mayor and for port commissioner that are already clearly pro-LNG and that already clearly have taken PSC money. But they're also trying to paint the Puyallup tribe in an extremely negative light that is really damaging to community relations, and it's directly affecting our elections, and I find that to be the most disturbing of all.
Well, I was thinking, Dan, the hearing for the Kalama Methanol SEIS last December in Longview, and there was a county commissioner who stood up and actually accused opponents of the methanol refinery of being racist. And I remember when you were listening to my documentary and you got to that point, you really winced in a way that it really disturbed you. And actually, I don't remember that, but I just heard third hand about you having that reaction. And I wonder about the kinds of attacks that people are experiencing in Kalama, which is a much smaller community than Tacoma, probably about the same size as, maybe it's even smaller
than
Coos Bay.
Than Coos Bay, yeah.
And how the kinds of attacks that happen and how that kind of also ties into greenwashing.
Yeah, I mean, they're not just greenwashing on climate issues. And I think Larry's description was really good in that he describes the scene of, you know, this kind of wonderland of wilderness. And then what does that have to do with digging a 230-mile trench across and basically building a highway across all of Southwest Oregon? A similar dynamic in Kalama, where they had everyone who showed up to speak in favor of the first of the methanol refinery, the first hearing, wore T-shirts that said Citizens for a Clean Green Economy.
And they were green T-shirts, right?
Green T-shirts, and there were a lot of them. And so, you know, people in Kalama who've been fighting this have been, you know, they've tried to say, oh, you're just a tiny minority, you don't represent the community. And it was 2,000 people in Kalama, and they actually elected a mayor who has been a vocal you know, critic of how this company has presented itself. And he said, you know, like a lot of people, when they first heard about the methanol refinery, you know, it wasn't the coal terminal. And so it, at least by comparison, seemed better than the worst idea possible, this huge coal terminal. And then, you know, they were trying to think like, well, what is this really going to mean for Kalama? And, you know, what we learn is that the more people get educated, the more time people spend talking to their neighbors, the more time people spend organizing, the more power we have in pushing back on these false narratives. And what's really important, I think, is that, you know, the people of Kalama got it right. They saw straight through this thing. A couple years ago, they were saying, there's no way this thing is only for plastic. They're clearly going to burn this for fuel. And they had done a bunch of research finding, you know, these the backers of this methanol project promoting this project for fuel. And of course, it's not as if they would support the project if it was for plastic, which is, you know, they were also questioning whether that analysis was reasonable. And, you know, now that they've essentially been borne out by the facts and by investigations into the company, what we see is the environmental impact statement really skewing, trying to pull the whole conversation back in the direction that the methanol company wanted. And so what we really need is for state agencies to referee this fairly. We've seen that with the Jordan Cove project. You know, as Jordan Cove is sending Larry a mailer about how clean and green and wonderful this thing is, the State Department of Environmental Quality is writing a 200-page report explaining how it's going to foul rivers and, you know, warm the water in salmon-bearing streams. You know, as the claim of methanol is trying to convince people in, you know, all over the Northwest that their project is going to be a benefit to the climate, people in Kalama are calling on ecology, the Department of Ecology, the state of Washington, to step in and interrupt the charade of these sort of cooked up environmental reviews that rely on just false or, you know, unrepresentative science.
So very ancient science that's really discredited.
Yeah, exactly. If you adopt like the most recent peer-reviewed studies about how much methane pollution results from using 300 million cubic feet of gas a day, what you find is that it's going to have a tremendous climate impact. And Northwest Innovation Works has bent over backwards to try to hide that. And so now they're getting, kind of like they've done in Coos Bay and Tacoma, they're getting more aggressive. We saw them last week send two emails, apparently to everyone who submitted a comment. It appeared as though many people forwarded me the email saying, you know, I never signed up for Northwest Innovation Works promo list. And their tagline, you know, was creating jobs and fighting climate change. And I'm not sure what building the world's largest gas to methanol refinery has with fighting climate change, but that's where they're taking it. That's where they're taking their argument. And, you know, I think what's really, really important is that people like Claudia and Larry and everyone in between in this whole vast, you know, power pass frack gas effort, you know, keeps working at kind of pulling back these falsehoods. I think that one last thing I want to just say is we can win at this. The oil industry tried this. The coal industry tried this. The LNG industry tried this on the Columbia River. The postcards they sent down to people in Clatsop County, at least one version, completely omitted Puget Island, Washington, which is the closest place where people actually lived to Bradwood LNG. You know, that facility was ultimately rejected by the people of the lower Columbia River. The oil industry tried to claim that oil spills were good for fish because it would stop people from fishing, and so more fish would survive. That's straight-faced argument they made, and obviously they failed. And so I, for people who are listening and wondering what we can do about this, you know, one, we need to continue to press the agencies who have an actual scientific and natural resource responsibility to do their job and to do it right. But secondly, it's changing the conversation and making sure that we are pointing people in the direction of real climate action and helping them understand that when they see these slick ads and these false narratives, That their gut is probably right. If it sounds too good to be true, it probably is.
Well, you are listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. We're talking today about the greenwashing of frack gas, and we're talking with Dan Sears, who's the conservation director with Columbia Riverkeeper, Claudia Riedner, who's co-founder of Redefine Tacoma, and Larry Magnan, a landowner in Coos County, Oregon, who's threatened by the Pacific Connector Pipeline. Well, in the remaining time we have, I'd like to talk about what's happening in these communities, particularly now in Tacoma and in Coos Bay, from Claudia and Larry. What are the next steps? I know, Larry, there's a big permit that's about to be decided. So what are you looking forward to in the next few weeks from the state, and what impact do you think that might have on the future of Jordan Cove?
Well, Barbara, you mentioned earlier about the city council meeting. Let me talk just shortly about that, because that was really, I won't say landmark, that would be too strong, but it was an incredible city council meeting for Coos Bay. Now, just as a little background, there's a part of the channel of the Coos Bay that has to be deepened by dredging, that it actually runs over part of the city of Coos Bay land. So the city council has to vote on that. And there was an incredible turnout to that city council meeting. I'd never seen, and people that have been to more kind of city council meetings than I said, they'd never seen such a large turnout. The room was packed. We'd had at least 100 plus people in the room, and then they overflowed into the foyer and then down the steps. There were probably 20, 30, 40 people on the steps of the city hall where they had set up a computer to watch what was going on inside. And so they had, we against it had all our red shirts on, and of course there was a sea of red shirts and a few of the green shirts. And they started out by letting the people for the project talk. And there were only about 10 or 11 folks that spoke on behalf of the project. And most of those were business owners, like the local cab owner, owner of the cab company, a representative from the port, and other businesses, real estate, that would directly benefit from the Jordan Cove. And then after that, there were probably about 10 to 1 against the project. But what was really nice to see is the city council did not make a rapid decision. They said there is so much information that they have to consider that they put off their decision for the city council until January 20th, I believe it is, of 2020. And that's really helpful. Sure, they kicked the can down the road, but they delayed the project. And that's what we honestly like to see, because the investors, when they start seeing Jordan Cove's been saying, well, the state has got problems, they don't know how to do the permit process. Well, it's the locals that are going slow with these projects as well. And in fact, at the end, when the council decided to delay it, a decision until January, Steve Pfeiffer, the attorney, he was pissed. I mean, he really went a little off his professional stature, I'd say, and I think actually did more damage for himself and his credibility with the council than he really should have. So it was a landmark. It was almost a landmark city council meeting, and a lot of us were really enthused by the actually lack of decision that the city council took at this point.
So what are you looking forward to as far as the next permit that we're going to hear about is the removal fill permit from the Department of State Lands? When is that determination happening?
Well, I understand it's going to be happening later this month, an unknown date, and we're keeping our fingers crossed. We had a great success with the Department of Environmental Quality when they turned down Jordan Cove's application for the clean water permit. And we're hoping that the state will do the same. We know that there's some very intense back and forth. DSL has been asking for more information from Jordan Cove, very detailed information from a number of the 16, 18 different commenters. And we're hopeful. We're hopeful that the DSL, like the DEQ, will turn it down. But who knows at this point?
And Claudia, up in Tacoma, there was this amazing hearing last Tuesday that Dan and I were at, and heard some really impassioned testimony. However, it seemed like this permit that they are, the clean air permit that is still being decided upon, that actually the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency's kind of said, well, we're going to approve it anyway, and this is before the comment period even ends. So what are you doing up there to take the next step?
Yeah, that was pretty disturbing that the air agency already predetermined to approve before ever even listening to any public comments. The public comment period ends September 9th, and you can go to the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency webpage and look for LNG, and that's how you get guided through how to make comments and where to send them to. We are organizing with many local and state groups. We're, of course, working with the Power Pass Fat Gas Coalition. We're taking guidance from the Puyallup tribe. We're working closely with them. And we have a group in Tacoma called Advocates for Cleaner Tacoma. They have already filed a lawsuit with the Department of Ecology, and more lawsuits will certainly be following. And so right now we're digging deeply into technical comments on this air permit, which is actually called a construction permit, which is really bizarre because, as everybody can see, the tank has already been built, the facility has already been built, and Puget Sound Clean Air Agency acts as if it is not there. In their greenhouse gas analysis, they are actually pretended that the tank had not been built yet. And so it's really difficult to take them at face value.
So what happens, I mean, this is one of the most frustrating things at all about this project, is that they've been building the tank without a permit for, what, for 2 years? So
right.
What are you, do you see your recourse as being?
Well, for one, we are continuing to call in on Governor Inslee, who, as a climate candidate, presidential candidate, had finally found it in himself to say that, in fact, we cannot build any new fat gas facilities. So we are calling on him to follow his words with actions, and we're also calling on the city council. We had a direct promise from Mayor Woodard that she would hire a new company and to actually conduct a new safety analysis. We had done public records requests for safety documents, and Puget Sound Energy took John Carlton to court, saying that because this was a terrorist target, they were, via Homeland Security Department, not allowed to share their safety documents. And they failed in court, and they appealed, and then again in Superior Court, they lost their case, and they had to release their safety documents. And it turned out they'd never done any analysis on the actual tank, if anything would happen, never mind a terrorist attack, but anything to the actual tank. And so after we'd done these public records requests just a few weeks ago, Advocates for Cleaner Tacoma got another records release from the city of Tacoma that showed that the Tacoma Fire Department had done a safety study on this tank, and they're saying that the gas cloud, if anything should happen to the tank itself, would travel 12.6 miles. And that puts all these communities in the vicinity at risk. And none of these communities in other cities, none of these other elected officials ever had a chance to actually have input in this entire situation. So we're hoping to alert all of the communities nearby and again urge the mayor to stand by her word and actually conduct a new safety analysis.
And in the meantime, you're going to be marching on the state capitol in a couple weeks?
That's true. There will be a four-day march to protect the Salish Sea, and that's organized by an indigenous-led group called Protectors of the Salish Sea. And the march will begin September 20th during the National Climate Action or the International Climate Action Week, and we'll start right here in the Port of Tacoma at the LNG tank, and then we'll be marching to Olympia, where on September the 24th, there will be a massive climate rally at the state capitol.
Well, sounds great, and we'll have more information about that in coming weeks. And Dan, I wanted to close out by talking about what's going on today on the Columbia River in relationship to another fossil fuel entity, which is the Trans Mountain Pipeline.
Yeah, and so for details, I would really suggest people go to Portland Rising Tide, and I think Stan has information up as well. They're the ones really leading this. But it was important to mention that today, I know that people are meeting up at 12 noon at Kelly Point Park and are going out in the Columbia River in solidarity with folks who are really drawing attention to a huge pile of the Trans Mountain Pipeline, apparently is out of the Port of Vancouver. And, you know, that pipeline across Canada is one of the truly climate destroying projects that's out there that's proposed. And, you know, it has enormous opposition from First Nations in Canada. And, you know, it's the kind of thing that just simply cannot happen if we plan to leave a livable climate for our kids.
Well, I was thinking last night about the irony. It was 4 years ago we were trying to stop the heavy haul corridor of these monster trucks that were hauling parts, components to build machinery to extract tar sands at the SAGD operations around Christina Lake and other parts of northeastern Alberta. And now 4 years later, we are trying to stop the pipeline parts that would be taking that tar sands and bringing it back down this way. So I guess it's ever never-ending fight.
That's right. And everyone's also really familiar with what's going on with Zenith. But just to mention that, you know, Portland still has an oil train terminal, you know, right in northwest Portland. And they are trying to basically keep that tar sands moving until they can get these pipelines established by shipping it via rail in all of these different directions, including right down here through Portland. So there will be more action coming on that as well. The next month, there's a tremendous amount of activity planned, whether it's in Southwest Washington dealing with Kalama, or a little bit further north in Olympia dealing with Kalama and Tacoma. And then obviously in Southern Oregon, where people have been at this for 15 years and I think are having a huge impact on stopping the Jordan Cove and Pacific Connector pipeline. I think if there's one thing that stitches together all of these fights, it's that, you know, communities around the region are standing up to frack gas, and together they're having a huge, huge impact on really dissolving this false messaging, this greenwashing that's been going on around so-called natural gas for decades. We're seeing a turning of the tide right now.
Well, thanks very much, Dan. I want to thank Dan Sears, Claudia Riedner, and Larry Magnan for joining us today. And thanks so much for the work that you're doing.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us on, Barb.
And we'll be in touch.
Thank you, Barbara.
Sure. Today we've been talking about greenwashing of frack gas with Claudia Riedner, co-founder of Redefine Tacoma, Larry Magnan in Coos County, Oregon, and Dan Sears, conservation director with Columbia Riverkeeper. And you've been listening to Locust Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in, you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locust-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our other KBOO public affairs programming, go to KBOO FM or listen on iTunes or Google Play or wherever you get your podcasts. Next week, we'll talk with Holly Mills, who's with Southern Oregon Rising Tide, about the surveillance of Jordan Cove and Pacific Pipeline opponents. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Tracy Nelson. Thanks for listening.